You are listening to the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian. Over a century ago, Oscar Wilde suggested that, quote, nowadays, people know the price of everything and the value of nothing. Our next guest says that we are blinded by prices and the so-called free market. As we've seen, the so-called market theory has not only failed, but he says it's also acted as a camouflage for activities that aren't about markets at all. Prices, he says, have little correspondence with their value or even their costs. We're joined by Raj Patel. He is the author of Stuffed and Starved and his latest book, The Value of Nothing, How to Reshape Market Society and Redefine Democracy. Welcome, Raj Patel.
Hi, Maria. Good to be here.
It's great to have you with us. Tell us about the camouflage that you think is occurring as a result of prices and markets.
It's pretty easy for us to see that in many ways, I mean, if you're concerned about climate change, if you're concerned about labor, if you're concerned about pretty much anything, the way that we're greeted with prices in the markets don't really tell us the full story about the exercises of power that it took to make the things that we're buying and selling. And if that sounds a little abstract, I mean, let's break it down to something very simple, like a hamburger. And we see a $4 hamburger in our local burger joint, but there's a lot that is hidden from us in that price. The environmental damage, for example, in making that hamburger. I mean, if the hamburger came from cows that were on pasture that once upon a time used to be rainforest. We heard a lot in the 80s about rainforest being chopped down to make pasture for cattle. If that's where the cow came from, then some researchers in India have said a burger shouldn't cost $4. It should cost nearer $200, because in losing that rainforest, we've lost biodiversity, we've lost carbon, we've lost the oxygen being produced. And that's hidden from us in the price, as are many other things, like the real cost of labor. I mean, if this hamburger is eaten in the United States, the chances are that the tomato in that hamburger will come from southern Florida, where since 1997, over 1,000 slaves, I mean, people in conditions of modern-day slavery, have been freed from captivity. So the price of our hamburger really hides a great deal in terms of labor, in terms of environmental damage, and it doesn't even include the healthcare costs that we'll pay after consuming the hamburger.
You also talked about some manipulations. In fact, you even used Wall Street itself as an example with the Volkswagen.
Well, that's right. This is just an absurdity of the way that the trading system works on Wall Street. The biggest corporation in terms of dollar value was, for a very short time, Volkswagen, the German auto manufacturer. And that was because of a series of weird transactions behind the scenes that drove up the price of Volkswagen shares astronomically, just because of a certain sense of manipulation and then the way that markets and hedge funds worked. But, of course, there's something very systematic about the way in which Wall Street has managed to shuffle off the risks associated with its bets. And so they were able to make a great deal of money in terms of bonuses and worry about the risks coming due in the next quarter. And, of course, when those risks came due, it was us who ended up picking up the pieces and paying the tab for that.
Now, the other thing that I thought was quite interesting was the other blinding that you talked about, the camouflage, which is the cultural camouflage and how we have become trapped and blinded to certain realities. You call it Anton's blindness. Part of this is this idea about market and society and that they're separated.
We've been so soaked in this idea that the only way we can value the world around us is if we put it in a market and stick a price label on it. That we've quite forgotten how, first of all, that sticking things in markets and putting price labels on them isn't a terribly good way of valuing things, as we've already seen, but also that there are other ways of valuing the world. And I liken it in the book to a disease called Anton's blindness. Now, Anton's blindness was named after a French neurologist called Gabriel Anton. He found this condition where people were cortically blind. In other words, the signals between their eyes and their brains weren't being transmitted. So they were, in every meaningful sense, blind, except for one thing, which is that they believed that they could see. And the way that you diagnose is that when they bump into things, their brains are telling them two different things. One, they believe that they can see, but on the other hand, they've just hit a hard thing and they don't know how it got there. And so they have to tell a story. They have to confabulate to be able to reconcile these two different facts. And this confabulation is how you diagnose the disease. But it's also a metaphor for how we've been blinded by the idea that markets are the only way to go. And when markets fail, as they have so spectacularly, the only thing that we're left saying is, well, if only there'd been better regulation, or if only AIG hadn't been, quite so disastrous, things would have been okay. But what we need to do is think about ways of moving beyond these so-called free markets to other ways of valuing the world around us that can actually be a little bit more robust But in order to ask that question, in order to get to that space, we do need to realize that actually what we believe we can see through the prism of free markets is an illusion.
And including what you say is the illusion that the market and society and the planet are separate.
Again, we're encouraged to believe that markets are these sort of God-given things, or that they are in some sense natural. And of course, they're nothing of the kind. It takes work to make markets. The example, if people want a sense of how markets are human-made, think about slavery. That there was a time when slavery was illegal, and then all of a sudden, particularly in the building of the United States, it was okay to have markets in people. But because of resistance, because of organizing, because of a range of things, it was decided then to stop having markets in people. The Civil War was fought in part about the rights of people and the limits to markets. And there's nothing natural about that, but somehow we've forgotten that markets depend on society. And of course, we've been reminded recently that free markets need society to catch them when they fall, and that's why we've assumed trillions of dollars of debt that our children will be paying off for quite some time to come.
You have also talked about other cultures and how perhaps this isn't really even natural for human beings. Cooperation, for example, is very natural, you say, in other societies. And you point out Indonesia, how the experiment where they keep 43% and give away 57%, whereas in the United States, it would be the reverse.
It is interesting that we have this idea that at heart, all human beings are wicked and selfish. And that's the way that nature has intended us. It's true that we have selfish genes, but it's not true that in order for us to survive as animals, we have to be selfish. In fact, quite the opposite is true. Through natural selection, we have become fit to survive in this environment only because not only are we selfish, but we are also capable of being cooperative, generous, and altruistic. This is a position that the Swiss philosopher Jean-Jacques Rousseau had. He understood that, yes, people are basically not terribly good, but what we also are is capable of learning to be better than purely selfish. And experiment after experiment has shown that even the most selfish people on Earth are capable of being a little bit more than purely selfish individuals. And that doesn't do a terribly good job of encouraging generosity and altruism. But there are cultures that do a much better job of that. That's something that we ought to remember. If we're going to come up with solutions about how to value resources together and how to find the real value of things other than through markets.
What I wanted to touch on was the studies of happiness and fairness and how these things reflect on people's generosity and this type of a thing. Even chimpanzees, the experiments have shown that they have a sense of fairness.
There's a range of experiments with primates, and even studies have looked at dogs and looked at how dogs that actually sort of socialize and play with others are more likely to survive than dogs that are individual and sort of try and make it by themselves as sort of solitary animals. In fact, there's a mortality rate that double if you try and be a sort of selfish dog than dogs that are able to work with others. And there are also experiments where, again, primates are sort of given an unfair situation. And if they were behaving as purely rational animals, they're confronted with an unfair situation where one of their partners is given more than they are in an exchange. And even though they had the opportunity to get at least something in the exchange, the fact that their partner got something very nice to eat and they got a cucumber, they actually threw the cucumber away because they said the primates thought that there was something very unfair about the situation. And this sense of that's not fair is something that actually we as humans also have. And this idea of fairness can trump the idea of just a selfish individual. I mean, if this animal was purely selfish, it would have taken the cucumber because the cucumber is better than nothing. But we're not wired that way. We're wired to look at others. We're wired with a sort of sense of fairness. And that's something, again, that can work for us in very positive ways.
There are two things I wanted you to address with this question. One of the questions is about how money and rights are actually related, because money buys liberty.
Oh, yeah.
And money buys rights to health care, to food, to housing. You've talked about this in your book. And the other thing is how the culture itself has changed about having the right to have rights.
Yes. One of the things that we're sold is that the free markets are about liberty. Free markets give us freedom. But in a free market, of course, you're only as free as the amount of money that you have. If you have a lot of cash, then you are able to buy health care. You are able to feed yourself and your family. You are able to travel wherever you like and live in a house. But in the U.S. today, because so many of our rights have been ceded to the free market, there were, for example, in 2008, 49.2 million Americans who were denied the right to food. In other words, 49.2 million Americans were food insecure. And they were food insecure not because there weren't free markets, but because through free markets, the only way that they could access food was through money. And if they didn't have money, they weren't guaranteed the right to food. And so although free markets seem to be about liberties, if you have no money in a free market, then freedom is just another word for nothing that you can afford. And that idea is something that I talk about in The Value of Nothing, because if you don't have money, then effectively you don't have any right to have rights. If you don't have cash, then you don't have the right to healthcare. You don't have the right to food. And this idea of having a right to have rights is something that's really been foreclosed. We've been denied the right to have rights because the right to property has trumped everything else.
So finally, you talked a bit about in the book the peasant movement, and you've talked about what happened with the food riots, with food sovereignty. Give us a sense of what the other alternatives are.
One of the alternatives, and one that's very specifically about the right to have rights, comes from an international peasant movement called La Via Campesina, and that is a movement that has 150 million members around the world, including here in the United States. And their vision is that what we need is democracy. Democracy is kind of the way that we get to have these rights. Or rather, a right to have rights. Via Campesina is interested in a democratic conversation about food. But in order to have that, we need to level the inequalities in power that prevent real democracy from happening. And that means addressing the inequalities that exist not only between rich and poor countries, where rich countries have enslaved poor countries with debt, but also even within the household, where inequalities and gender relations still persist and are fundamental to the way modern society operates. And so Via Campesina have this amazing slogan that food sovereignty is about an end to all forms of violence against women. And this idea that a peasant movement could come up with an idea that in order for us to have rights, we need to start with equalizing power within the household all the way up to international levels, gives you a sense of, firstly, how big a vision this is and how much work there is to do, but also how hopeful the transformation away from the sort of market society we have at the moment to a different kind of market society can be.
Well, Raj Patel, I want to thank you so much for being with us. This has been a wonderful conversation.
Thank you so much. I've really enjoyed it.
Raj Patel is the author of The Value of Nothing, How to Reshape Market Society and Redefine Democracy.